ask what had happened or how my hardware got made in time, Roy Lee pulled me aside. "Sonny, Miss Riley's in the hospital." Dad waited at the Buick. Mr. Dubonnet and Mr. Caton were loading my stuff in its trunk. Mom came over. "Go on with the boys. I'll tell you everything later." Quentin, Roy Lee, Sherman, Odell, Billy, and I crept down the quiet, polished halls of Stevens Clinic in Welch. We found Jake sitting beside Miss Riley's bed. She was propped up, looking very pale, and there was a tube leading into her arm. Her voice was a whisper. "Hi, boys. Sonny. Back from the fair? How did you do?" I showed her the medal. She smiled at each of us. "You did it! I always knew you would. I'm so proud to be your teacher." "Miss Riley," I realized suddenly that I loved her, that I had never known or ever would know anyone as good as she. "Can I hold the medal?" she asked. "It's yours. We wouldn't have won it without you." I pinned it to her pillow. She turned her pretty face to look at it. I tried without success to swallow the thickness in my throat. I was raging inside. Why had God made her sick? Where was the grace of the Lord that Reverend Lanier talked about? Was this an example of it, knocking down a young woman who wanted only to teach? When she closed her eyes and seemed to drift away, I looked at Jake. He shook his head and led us outside. "She'd just gone to sleep. They keep her pretty well doped up. Is she going to die?" He didn't answer me directly. "She'll be back teaching after the doctors build her up a bit. Your medal will give her a good boost, I know." Jake walked us outside to Roy Lee's car. He split me off from the others. "Sonny, don't let this spoil what you did. You should be proud." I shook my head. "Jake, it doesn't make any sense." Jake jammed his hands in his pockets, sighed, and looked up at the mountains. "I'm not a religious man, Sonny. You want parables and proverbs, go to church, but I believe there's a plan for each of us, you and me, Freda Riley too. Doesn't help to get mad about it or want to whip up on God about it. It's just the way it is. You've got to accept it." He looked around. "These old mountains can weigh anybody down. When you get away from them, well, there's a whole other world out there. You'll see." I thought about what lay ahead of me. I didn't mean to say it. I thought it, and it just popped out. "I'm scared of the future, Jake." Jake turned toward me but hesitated. He'd been in West Virginia long enough for our terrible stolidity to rub off on him. Then, with a laugh, he threw his arm over my shoulders and hugged me close. "Old son, we're all scared of that." Gratefully, I leaned against him and thought of Saturday nights long ago, when once my father carried me up the stairs. It took me a while, but I finally managed to piece together what happened in Colwood after my nozzles got stolen. In less than an hour, the fence line telegraph had alerted the whole town that I was in trouble. Mr. Caton headed for the machine shop, but a line of union men, including Mr. Dubonnet, stopped him. Although Dad said the best thing to do was nothing, Mom made him drive her to the machine shop. Then he saw Mr. Dubonnet and got out of the Buick and went nose to nose with him. Mom was ready to let them fight it out, she said, but Mr. Caton pushed in between and said, "Now look here, you won't find a better union man than me, and I know we don't have no contract, but we've got to help that boy. He's not up there just for himself. He's up there for Colwood." That was when Mr. Bundini, the company's new manager of the mine, showed up in his Jeep and told everybody to break it up. Odell said Mr. Bundini had a big smile and went over and took Mr. Dubonnet and Dad aside. Mom sighed as she told me the story. It turns out that our Ohio owners had made a big deal with General Motors. It needed coal and fast. The union could have asked for little pink hearts to be pasted on their lunch buckets, and the company would have given it to them. So Mr. Bundini got Mr. Dubonnet's signature and your dad's on the agreement right there on the spot. There was just one catch. Your dad said to me that if he signed this thing, he'd have to stay. He couldn't go to Myrtle Beach. Mom shook her head, looked out at her rose garden and her telephone pole thick fence which the company carpenter had built after I blew up her old one. Well, what else could I say but what I did? I had to do it for you, didn't I? I said, sign it, Homer. She looked back at me. Your dad asked me if I was staying with him. I told him if I did, he didn't deserve it. Then you know what he said? No, ma'am. He said that was the truth. She poured herself a cup of coffee. Well, how could a woman leave a man who admitted he wasn't good enough for her? Graduation night finally came, and the Big Creek High School class of 1960 walked proudly down the aisle in the gymnasium to receive our diplomas, the boys in green gowns, the girls in white. Dorothy was our valedictorian. Quentin, his B's and phys ed catching up with him, was the salutatorian, tied with Billy. Sherman and Odell were in the top 10. Roy Lee and I were back in the pack. Mr. Turner had placed my National Science Fair medal in the trophy case of gleaming football awards along with an award certificate that read, A Study of Amateur Rocketry Techniques, Homer H. Hickam, Jr., Big Creek High School, War, West Virginia, Gold and Silver Award, 1960. The boys and girls of Big Creek went back to their chairs and held their diplomas and looked at one another, filled with present joy and impending loss. Dorothy left before I could talk to her. I took Melba June to the graduation dance that night. Dorothy wasn't there. I would not see her again for 25 years. After graduation, the BCMA gathered in my room. In a more perfect world, perhaps everything would have worked out as Quentin hoped, and we would have all gotten scholarships because of our win. It didn't happen. Instead, Odell, Billy, and Roy Lee took the Air Force recruiter up on his offer. Immediately after graduation, they were headed for Lackland Air Force Base for basic training, and then they would use the GI Bill for college. Sherman said his parents had come up with some money for him to go to West Virginia Tech, and he was going to work for the rest of it. I decided to take my mother up on her offer of an Elsie Hickam scholarship. I was still trying to decide which college to go to, but I thought maybe the engineering program at the Virginia Polytechnic Institute. Quentin may not have gotten his scholarship either, but he said if boys from McDowell County, West Virginia, could win a prize at the National Science Fair, he was sure he could figure out how to go to college, even if he didn't have any money. He had decided to enroll at Marshall College in Huntington, West Virginia. He wasn't certain how he was going to pay for it, but he'd figure it out when he got there. Somehow I knew he'd do fine. The only thing left for the BCMA to do was to decide what to do with the 6 rockets I had brought back from Indianapolis. Sherman suggested we split them among us for souvenirs, but Quentin wouldn't hear of it. Sonny, I've got a great idea. See, we get this big balloon, and we fill it full of helium. Then we hang our best rocket from it and let it float up about 10 miles and then launch. I've done the calculations. We'll make it into space. Odell had another thought. Let's make a day of it. Launch from morning to night. We'll put up notices, have the paper write us up. We'll make it a big deal. Roy Lee, Sherman, and Billy all said they liked it. Quentin sat down hard on the edge of the bed. We could have done it, you guys. We could have gone into space. Roy Lee laughed. Ah, Quentin, it's a miracle we ever got anything off the ground at all. Let's do this and get out of town while we still can. For the last time, we posted our little notices at the big store in the post office. My basement lab stank one last time with our propellant mix of zinc dust, sulfur, and moonshine, 6 rockets curing at once. All the boys came to help, and the fumes left us all a little giggly. I woke early on the first Saturday in June, the day of the final launches. I moved to my window as I had done so many times before to look out at the mountains and the highway that led past the mine. I half expected to see the usual line of miners making their way on the path to and from the tipple, and Dad among them, getting his reports, giving his encouragements and directives, but the path was empty. The mine hadn't gone to a full 7-day shift, even with the new orders for coal. I heard the familiar sound of the backyard gate opening and closing, and there was Dad, going alone up the path to the mine. He walked hurriedly with his head down, as if the world depended on him getting to his office not a moment late. His hands were jammed deep in the pockets of his loose canvas pants, and his dented hat sat on the back of his head. Along the way, he suddenly stopped and doubled over with a hacking cough. They had found a spot on his lung recently. That was supposed to keep him out of the mine, but Dad had ignored the medical order. A car came down the road from the Welch direction and turned right toward Town Central. Another followed it, and then another. When I went to the kitchen and made myself breakfast, I heard the faint rumble of more cars and trucks passing the house. I thought for a moment they might be going to our launch, but that wasn't possible. It wasn't to begin for another 2 hours. Before I left, I took a look around my room and suddenly felt as if I'd returned to it after being gone for 50 years. There were my shelves, heavy with books and stacks of notepaper filled with the calculations that had defined our rockets. There was my little dresser and the airplane models on top. Pieces of rockets, old nose cones, bent casements, and scarred nozzles were scattered everywhere. The feeling of being gone and then returning was so strong I had to sit down on my bed for a while. I sat alone, everything quiet except for the sound of cars and trucks passing by. Roy Lee came to the back door, knocking politely. I met him in the kitchen. Mom was at the kitchen table in front of her beach painting, which she had finally finished. There was a beach house and a woman standing in front of it looking out to sea. She gave me a look that defied interpretation. "Don't blow yourself up." "Yes, ma'am." Quentin arrived as we were loading rockets in the back seat of Roy Lee's car. AUK 31 was so long we had to roll down the window to fit it in. Billy was waiting with Sherman on the bridge that crossed over the creek to Sherman's house. They wedged into the front of Roy Lee's car. We met Odell at the Frog Level crossroads, and he squeezed into the back in between rockets, careful not to bend the fragile fins. We spoke little. A mile before we got to Cape Colwood, we came upon the first parked car. The sheriff was there. He motioned us to him.
"Bet there's never been so many cars in Colwood since it was built. I'm going to park 'em alongside the road, single file. The people can walk in from there."
We were astonished at the number of cars and people. Behind us, more were coming. Roy Lee had put 2 cases of pop and a gallon jug of water in the trunk to offer our audience. We were going to be a bit short. Some people saw the rocket sticking out of the window, and shouts of encouragement rang out.
"The Rocket Boys! Hoo! We're proud of you, boys! A-OK! All systems go!"
We drove out on the slack and unloaded our rockets with tender care. I looked up the road past several curves and could see the sun sparkling off parked cars as far as I could see. The Colwood Woman's Club was setting up a picnic table with all kinds of pastries and jugs of punch and tea. The sheriff reserved special places of honor for Sherman's and Odell's parents and Roy Lee's mother. It was noon by the time we were ready to get our first rocket off. We ran up our flag. It was the same one Odell's mom had made for us nearly 3 years before, a little tattered but still serviceable. Wind was negligible. Quentin disappeared downrange, trailing telephone wires and carrying his theodolite. A hush fell over Cape Colwood. I looked through the blockhouse portal before beginning the first countdown and saw Miss Riley sitting at the Woman's Club table. 2 of the grade 6 teachers were fanning her. Jake stood by with Mr. Turner. AUK 26 had a simple countersink nozzle. It zipped off the pad and flew nicely downrange, as if buoyed by the cheers and applause. 3,000 feet, we all agreed, and the altitude was reported to the crowd, which oohed and awed appropriately. AUK 27 was a 1 1/4-inch wide, 3.5-foot-long rocket designed to reach 10,000 feet. When it took off, it jumped from the pad on a silvery column of smoke, stuttered strangely in little puffs, and then seemed to find its way, another spout of fire sending it hurtling skyward. Since it had been the last rocket we'd loaded, maybe the fuel had not entirely cured. The crowd, still growing, took no notice of its problems and clapped and yelled exuberantly as it disappeared. It hit with a ground-shaking thunk downrange. 9,000 feet. Not bad for a little rocket not given time to cure. We hauled out AUK 28 and set it up. It was designed for 15,000 feet. It worried me for a moment when it bent slightly toward the crowd before straightening up and flying past Rocket Mountain, accelerating on a thick plume of smoke. "It's going to land behind the mountain," Billy predicted, and he was right. We saw it fall, but the noise of the crowd was too great for us to hear the familiar twang of steel hitting rock and mountain earth. I started to tell him to wait, we'd pick it up later, but Billy was off on a run, heading up the mountain. Some of the men from the crowd joined his trek. A half hour later, they all came running back with Billy holding the rocket over his head, yellow jackets in close pursuit. The crowd scattered. Jake moved to stand over Miss Riley with a folded newspaper, but the angry bees had too many targets and gave up in confusion, retreating back up the mountain. AUK-29 and AUK-30 were both designed for 20,000 feet, but with different dimensions. 29 was 2 inches in diameter, 32 1/4, but shorter. AUK-29 was 6 feet long, the longest rocket we had ever fired. It was such a beauty. I almost regretted having to launch it and see it shattered back on Earth. It took off in the mightiest roar ever witnessed at Cape Colwood, tearing out of a cauldron of flame and smoke. Our calculations put it just under 4 miles. AUK-30 vaulted off the pad similarly, its parabola drifting up to 23,000 feet. I looked downrange and saw Quentin out on the slack, joyfully jumping up and down. AUK-31 was our last and biggest rocket, 6.5 feet long, 2 1/4 inches in diameter. We carefully raised it into a vertical position and then lowered it on the launch rod. Inside it was the nozzle touched by Dr. von Braun. It had been designed to reach an altitude of 5 miles. I knelt at its base and started twisting together the ignition wire connections. Roy Lee tapped me on the shoulder. "Sonny, do you see who's here?" I looked up from my work. The sheriff opened a path through the crowd, and there stood Dad in his work clothes. Roy Lee went after him, escorted him out on the slack. I heard Roy Lee say, "Come and help us, Mr. Hickam." Dad entered the blockhouse, and I directed him to the firing panel after checking the connections. "This one's yours, Dad, if you want it." There was no mistaking the pure delight I saw spread across his face as he knelt in front of the panel. Roy Lee called from the back door, "Whenever you're ready." I counted down to zero and Dad turned the switch. AUK-31 erupted, blowing huge chunks of concrete loose from the pad. The crowd took a step backward and some of them started to run. AUK-31 seemed to split the air that filled the narrow valley, a shockwave rippling across the slack. Women screamed and men clapped their hands to their ears. We boys came pouring outside, Billy at his theodolite, Odell with his binoculars. The thunderous din didn't stop. AUK-31 kept pounding us as it climbed. Men, women, and children all watched it with mouths agape, eyes wide, their cheers stuck in their throats. At the big store, those few old men not at the launch stood uncertainly to their feet as the thunder reached them. They stumbled into the road, shading their eyes, the trunk of fire and smoke tearing out of the mountains like God's finger stuck suddenly toward the sky. Roy Lee kept his eye on his watch. 38, 39, 40. Billy peered into the sky. "Still see it." The great spout of smoke turned into a dim yellowish streak. "Just about gone." 43, 44. "Gone." Gone at 44 seconds. I did a quick calculation. Assuming it was flying nearly vertical, AUK-31 had disappeared at an altitude of 31,000 feet, nearly 6 miles high. I became aware of movement beside me, and I was astonished to see Dad prancing along the slack, waving his old hat in his hand. He was exulting to the sky. "Beautiful! Beautiful!" As AUK-31 raced across the sunlit sky on that glorious day, I watched instead my dad, and waited patiently and with hope for him to put his arm around my shoulder and tell me at last that I had done something good. I heard Billy yell, "There! There it is!" People surged from the road across the slack, following the other boys as they raced after our last great rocket. Dad stopped his dance and put his hat over his heart. He bent over as if a great weight had suddenly been dropped on his back. He looked at me, his mouth open, and I saw in his eyes a curious mixture of happiness and pain that dissolved into fear. I went to him and put my arm around his shoulder, supporting him while he fought for air. A spasm of deep, oily coughs racked his body. "You did really good, Dad. Nobody ever launched a better rocket than you." All of us rocket boys would go to college, something not likely in pre-Sputnik West Virginia. Roy Lee became a banker. Odell went into insurance and farming. Quentin, Billy, Sherman, and I became engineers. Sherman died unexpectedly of a heart attack when he was only 26 years old. My brother became a high school football coach. As we hoped and prayed, Miss Riley's disease went into remission. When it returned several years later, she continued to teach, even when it was necessary for her students to carry her up the steps to her classroom. Frieda Joy Riley died, barely 31 years old, in 1969. I volunteered for Vietnam, delaying my dream of working on spaceflight. The irony was not lost on me when I climbed out of a bunker one morning and found a dud Russian 122-millimeter rocket buried nearby. I inspected its nozzle and thought it crudely designed. I never got to meet Wernher von Braun. After building the rocket that took his beloved adopted country to the moon, he died of colon cancer in 1977. Vietnam and other work delayed me, but in 1981, 21 years after the BCMA fired its last rocket, I finally grasped the dream of my youth and became a NASA engineer at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, Dr. von Braun's old headquarters. Over the years that followed, many of the men and women on his team became my colleagues and friends. I trained astronauts, talked them through their science experiments while they were in orbit, and often went to Cape Canaveral for launches of the space shuttle and other rockets. I went to Russia and sat across the table from the men who launched Sputnik 1, and worked with men and women from Japan, Canada, Europe, and across the planet who shared the vision of space exploration with me. My career with NASA was everything I hoped and dreamed it would be. My father resisted his black lung and kept going into the mine. After his forced retirement at age 65, Dad stayed as a consultant with the company for 5 more years, living in the clubhouse. My mother moved to Myrtle Beach, finding at last the scene in her painting. When his lungs finally gave out and his miners refused to let him on the man trip anymore, Dad joined her there. He died of his disease in 1989. One day, feeling a need to connect with a past I had all but forgotten, I started to open some old boxes Mom sent me when she and Dad had moved from Colwood years before. All of them but one had Mom's handwriting on it. I recognized Dad's crabbed scrawl on a small brown cardboard box. "Sonny" was all he had written. I opened it, and there I found, carefully folded within layers of tissue paper, what I thought had been lost long ago. Faded ribbons and medals and a strange artifact. A perfectly crafted steel De Laval rocket nozzle. In November 1997, just before I retired from NASA, an astronaut friend of mine carried aboard Space Shuttle Columbia one of my science fair medals and a piece of the AUK nozzle my father kept for me. As I watched the great ship blast off from the Cape Canaveral pad, I was filled with pride and happiness. The BCMA was finally going into space. Sometimes now I wake at night thinking I have heard the sound of my father's footsteps on the stairs, or the shuffling boots and low murmur of miners going to work. In that half-world between sleep and wakefulness, I can almost hear the ringing of a hammer on steel and the dry hiss of the arc welder at the little machine shop by the tipple. But it is only a trick of my imagination. Nearly everything that I knew in Colwood is gone. The miners' houses are deserted. The great slack dump we called Cape Colwood has been bulldozed, overgrown, browsed now by deer, silent to boyhood voices. The deep mine is abandoned, its tunnels flooded, the equipment inside covered with black water. Nothing commemorates the site, only rubble and faded signs and overgrown thickets where hundreds of men once toiled and sometimes died. Colwood's industrial symphony is forever stilled. All that remains are distant echoes and husks of what used to be. Yet I believe Colwood still lives. Our fathers still trudge up the old path to the mine, and the people bustle in and out of the big store and gather on the church steps after Sunday services. The fences still buzz with news and gossip, and the mountains and hollows echo with the joyful clamor of childhood adventures. The halls and classrooms of the old schools still hum with the excitement of youth, and the football fields yet roar with celebration on cold fall Friday nights. Even now, Colwood endures, and no one, nor careless industry or overzealous government, can ever completely destroy it. Not while we who once lived there may recall our life among its places, or especially remember rockets that once leaped into the air, propelled not by physics, but by the vibrant love of an honorable people, and the instruction of a dear teacher, and the dreams of boys.
Rocket Boys, a memoir, was written by Homer H. Hickam, Jr. It was read by Beau Bridges, with an introduction by the author. It was abridged for audio by Jesse Boggs. The recording engineer was Bob Schreiner. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. The mix engineer was Rick Bradley. The associate producer was Sloan Seaman. The director was David Purdom. Rocket Boys, a memoir, was produced by Susan Perrin. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.